she said, "Do you come from a land down under, where women glow and men plunder? Can't you hear the thunder? Yeah. You better run, you better take cover. Yeah. You better run, you better take cover."
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Cider Nation podcast, a unique baseball podcast. Brought to you by the Bean Bowl Coffee Company. Make sure to check them out on social media and grab some of their amazing coffee. Today, we have former professional right-handed pitcher, John Huizinga. Thanks for coming on, John.
My pleasure.
I guess first things first, could you talk to us a little bit about your arm slot story and how that all came about?
Well, I think, you know, especially as a kid, I grew up in a gravel pit. And I used to like to skip a lot of rocks. Yeah. So it was kind of something that always came instinctive, I guess, for me. When I started using it pitching, I typically would use it like later in a count. I was always kind of a low three quarter, just naturally. And then Sometimes I'd get to like, especially early on, like 0-2, 1-2, I'd start to drop down on guys. My college pitching coach, Joe Fletcher, my senior year at Michigan State, had kind of played with some different slots with me, was really working on keeping my head still and improving command. I had some issues with my front side flying, which I think a lot of guys do, but
yeah.
But I think just as I continued to go, it just felt more and more natural and instinctive. And I felt like I hid the ball better and, you know, hitters would ask me what the heck I was throwing. So I think I liked the deception, being on my side.
Yeah.
So I think I just kind of continued to trend in that direction. And then I would say, let's see. I started pro ball in 2002, 2006. When I was in Calgary, I would say it was the first year that I was mainly lower. And then I would go a little bit higher, you know, on left-handers or if I was throwing cutters or, you know, I'd kind of vary just a little bit. But
yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, like what pitches did you throw, John? And kind of what velocity were you at with your arm slot there?
So I would typically sit like 92, 94. I was as high as 98. I actually threw harder when I dropped down than I did over the top. The hardest I ever threw, I guess, from the three quarter slot was about 94. And then, yeah, I guess I went up 3-4 miles an hour as I dropped down. I think I was just more stable.
Yeah.
I was able to rotate a little better.
Yeah.
And then as far as which pitches I threw, early on, it was a sinker and a split. And then I started to pick up a slider that was more of like the gyro slider, if you will, or more like the depth one.
Okay.
Kind of go down. And then I started throwing a sweeper. So nowadays I can throw a few different breaking balls from that slot. And then I can throw a split or a changeup. It's almost like a split between my index and my pinky that I use. And then just kind of feel like, you know, especially from that slot, it naturally kind of just, as my arm's unwinding, it just rolls right into that.
I know this can be a tricky question, but like, is there any mechanical tips that you'd have from the low slot?
I think as natural, or I guess natural is not the word, instinctive as you can be. It does become natural through reps. But I typically, I'll do a lot of different stuff with like tennis racket or even like some volleyball smash, different ways of finding which plane of motion you rotate on. You know, cause some guys are a little bit better, let's say just slightly under. Some guys, typically we try to stay away from the even slot cause I think it tends to create more just run versus if we're looking to create sink and depth. But I think staying athletic in your throwing drills and especially your catch play is a good way to do it. I love to take guys up to Sedona. I've got a spot up there that we go and we skip rocks.
Nice.
And I think a lot of times you find your instinctive slot that way when it's more of an external focus than an internal focus. So the rock is basically giving you the feedback versus having a mechanical thought or cue. We try to stay away from mechanics as much as possible and just let things be instinctive and natural.
Yeah, I definitely sometimes had a bad habit. And actually, honestly, it's like probably more like when I got into golf, like just that Rolodex of thoughts in my head and just definitely didn't help.
Yeah, and it's funny how how similar those two sports are. You know, I think that's why you see a lot of pitchers that use golf as a cross training because of especially the mental side.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it a lot of times what it comes down to is that external focus versus internal focus.
Yeah.
How to versus, hey, what does a good pitch look like here? Or what does a good shot look like here?
Yeah. And it's definitely, it's kind of one of those weird things. Like when I thought like a pitcher, that's when I would hit the ball far golf wise. But as soon as I started thinking like a hitter, just cause I had a club in my hands, that's where I would have like a snap hook or I'd forget to use my legs.
That's funny. Yeah. Cause you can crush a golf ball. I've seen you just mash them.
Doesn't translate on a golf course, but
are you still doing it or?
No, but I've hit a couple balls this year and I'm like, I probably could, like, I guess I could go in the seniors division now, unfortunately, but
good for you. Right?
We'll see. Yeah. John, like any advice for anyone kind of debating on changing their arm slot or maybe just someone that just recently dropped down?
I would say stick with it.
Yeah.
A big thing we encourage our guys is, you know, get a little better every day. So like, feel like instead of, I think sometimes guys think they're going to, you know, drop down or change a slot and they feel like, they're going to do that construction with a sledgehammer. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times what I encourage guys to do is think like more, you're going to use a chisel and sandpaper. So you're going to stay athletic like you threw, and you're just going to change the plane that you throw on, but you still need to stay athletic and you still want to stay like we're talking about instinctive. And I think the more you can stay away from mechanical thoughts, the better off you're going to be. Yeah. And the more, you know, we do a lot of stuff, eyes closed, a lot of close net stuff. So typically, you know, we'll take guys in, we're going to go through a activation. And then we're going to go through a series of close net stuff, which I guess nowadays you see some guys do with a plyo ball, but we typically do it with a baseball, sometimes with a football, because the football really gives immediate feedback, or we love the clean fuego training device, or even just taking a marker and marking the ball. So you're getting feedback from the baseball that's external, and then set up a camera. If you've got a radar gun, set up a camera and a radar gun and go through and look at that after. Look at the results after and go through your feels, especially with the close net. And then as you start to play catch, same thing, just stay athletic. Stay away from becoming too robotic or too, you know, I think a lot of times you see some guys drop down, if you will, and they get unathletic.
Hmm. Yeah, kind
you
of
know,
force it.
I mean, you see the opposite too, where you see guys that all of a sudden you're like, oh, wow, now that arm works, you know, but there's different, I guess, a difference in when you're focused on the outcome versus the how to.
Yeah.
You know, obviously there's a time and place for both of those things, but I think allow yourself time to kind of tinker, and we just call it trial and error.
Any kind of advice, John? Like, I know like velocity is definitely part of the game right now. And it's a question I get asked all the time. Like, how do I gain more velocity from down there? And I know it's part of it, but like any advice for, from that standpoint?
Well, I think you want to train on plane. So find a plane that you want to throw on or that your body, you know, instinctively throws on, and then train yourself in those positions. you know, and there's stuff, we do a lot of stuff with water bags, or even a barbell is a really good, training device with no weight. Sometimes you can add, you know, maybe a 5 or 10 on each side with a bungee or a rubber band so that you feel stability. But I'd say when you're looking for more command, look for more, or excuse me, more velo, command comes too. But when you're looking for more, start with stability. Mm-hmm. And then once you've created better stability, you're going to find that you can rotate better. And now that you can rotate better, you're going to find that the ball's coming out faster. Just mm-hmm. does, you know? So typically, you know, we have a little mix that we run guys through, which you and I will be talking about next, but going through a progression on the slope, and we'll typically see 3 to 5 with guys increased, like right on the spot, just because they're learning how to use their body better versus yeah. like, I think sometimes you see, let's say a velocity program or something that's going to take you 8 to 12 months to, you know, to go through a full program. Versus like sometimes with this, you can see an immediate 3 to 4 with what you already have. Hmm. And I think that a lot of guys have success with that. The PVC pipes, another thing that we like a lot for instant feedback. And it, you know, basically just shows you what plane you're on. So a lot of times I think the misfires or the losses in velo or command, we call it a misfire, but when guys typically misfire, it's because they fail to wind on the same plane as they unwind. Almost everybody can unwind really well, but once you find, or another way to say closing your shoulders, you know, that's your winding up versus your unwind. And I think once guys get better and better and better at that, they'll find more consistent velo and command.
Yeah. And it was kind of one of those tricky things. I know definitely when I dropped down, I kind of had a habit of probably focusing too much on my, you know, my upper body. And I would kind of forget about my lower half for sure.
Yeah. I think I see that a lot, you know, yeah. So we even do some stuff that's, if anybody follows our social media, you're going to see a drill that we do called the Hall of Famer, but the backside is on a punching bag or on a med ball, or, you know, there's different devices we use, but getting yep. into the backside so guys can get that feeling. Yep. And then we'll typically do figure eights because rotationally, like once again, what we were saying a minute ago, but the counter and the unwind or the wind and the unwind is typically where we're going to start. And it's almost like, since we were talking about cold weather earlier, ice fishing auger, where you'll take okay. an auger, you stick it in the ice, and then you turn the top. And when you turn the top, it turns the bottom. Hmm. So that's kind of the idea that we start to get, where it's like, okay, when guys learn how to counter and and wind and unwind, wind and unwind, wind and unwind in that stable position, all of a sudden they find their center. And then once they start moving from center, things start looking more and more athletic, and guys are more consistent.
What did it look like long toss wise for you, John? Like kind of from an arm slot standpoint, like how far did you go back, and did you kind of long toss from the lower slot?
Great question. Typically we'll start with a football.
Okay.
We like to throw the football, and then kind of same thing where, you know, you can watch like a guy like, a Mahomes or a athletic thrower. And you can see how they can throw from different slots, or like a Stafford. I like watching Stafford, but starting to throw the football there, doing some goofy foot throws, and then typically just stay athletic on the way out. And I mean, I did long toss, and I really had less thought about the slot. It was more about the shape that I was looking to create or hitting the spot. And then, okay. as I worked back into like 90 and started to go in change ups and two seams, then I'd start to allow that slot to kind of become closer to what it was. But I think, you know, the more I videoed it, even at 90 feet, it's not going to be the same slot as you're going to see at 60 feet, 6 inches, especially downhill.
Yeah.
So I think throwing out the idea that it's got to look exactly the same, because I think, you know, there's, in fact, there's a fair amount of research out there now that it's like we never repeat anything.
It's no.
We can be consistent in a release point. You know, the really good guys hit a consistent release point, but how they do it is they're not repeating. Mm. They're adjusting and they're adapting. And that's where we continue to kind of take guys' focus as they're playing catch. Be athletic, move your feet. You know, I encourage guys to throw like a shortstop, throw like a third baseman, you know, do backhands, do pickoffs, do we do a drill called a turn and burn, but it's very close to like if you were playing first or third and you were a cutoff and you're going to throw somebody out at home plate, you receive that throw, you move your feet and then throw. So a lot of times we'll have guys find their slot that way too, you know, as they come in and then let the distance dictate that slot. And especially once you get on the slope, because even flat ground's not going to be the same as it is off the mound.
No.
So no, I think, you know, just really encouraging guys to get all that work in, but especially if you're going to work on your pitching and you're going to work on a slot, work on it off of a slope.
And then I guess, John, like when you dropped down, like, was there any kind of pitchers that you kind of emulated or watched?
Absolutely. I mean, Pedro Martinez was a guy where I felt like that was kind of my slot normally. Yeah. Yep. So that was like my low three quarter. And then Dennis Eckersley was a guy that I absolutely loved growing up, you know, and we'd play like backyard wiffle ball or whatever. Kevin Brown was my all time favorite as far as my delivery goes, because he would do both slots kind of like I did.
Yeah.
So I really liked watching him, especially when he was with the Padres and the Marlins, like in the late 90s.
Yeah, he was fun to watch.
Nowadays there's so much more access to video, you know, coming up. I didn't have as much, but like guys like Walter Johnson, you know, even a Bob Feller, like, you know, watching a guy like Nolan Ryan, I think a lot of guys think that, you know, Nolan's not sidearm, but Nolan's also not over the top. Nolan's like a power three-quarter slot.
Very
true. You know, and I think, you know, just watching more and more guys that way, I'd say Kevin Brown to come back, but Kevin Brown probably my favorite, and then Pedro, and then Dennis Eckersley.
Walter Johnson always kind of fascinates me. I've always kind of been curious. It doesn't even look like he's throwing.
I love Walter Johnson. So I've done a lot of research on him, read his biography, autobiography. Yeah. His son wrote a book about him, about his upbringing, a lot of this stuff. And it's when we talk about effortless velo, if you will, or what looks like effortless, there is the effort comes in when you're not on the mound. But he grew up baling a lot of hay.
Okay.
So for anybody out there that's ever baled hay before, especially if it's wet, a bale of hay is between 80 and 100 pounds. And if you can imagine a trailer, you know, at about your shoulder height, and you have to pick that thing up and put that thing on the trailer all day, you know, it makes you strong. And it's a rotation and it's a stability. It's literally like if we had to take one exercise we could do, we'd just bale hay. And what we do is we'd pick it up on one side of our body, stabilize, rotate, and set it over to the other side of the body up high. Yeah, and then all of a sudden you're throwing a 5-ounce ball or whatever, and it's like just a flick of the wrist. You know, but it's like, yeah, I love watching his lower half. It literally looks like he's just handing it to the catcher. It's beautiful.
No, and then obviously I have to credit you. Like when I dropped down, you helped me a lot, and definitely I appreciate that, and made it kind of like an easy transition.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was I remember when Bushy came up to me one day and talked to me about something, and then just you know, Freeborn down there, you know, why don't you I think it was play catch next to him or something like that, and start to drop some tips on him. And I'm like, that guy, I like that guy gladly, you know. He was, I think we were like right by each other in the locker room too, so it kind of was it was a pretty fun little fit. And then we get to sit in the bullpen together, and
it was a weird day. I basically went from probably getting released to like having my first pro win in like 24 hours. It was a very weird
Yeah, and then you were an all-star the next year.
And then the all-star. So I'm glad I did. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. I mean, it was so fun watching you because it was, you moved so, you're like one of those guys where it was, I don't want to say instant because it wasn't instant, but it was,
no,
it was quick. Like you picked it up really quick. And I think it was something that was almost innate. It was something that was almost already inside of you, the way that the stabilize and rotate.
Yeah. Like
from that slot.
I think I dropped down twice in junior college. And I remember it just felt good, but my, like the pitching coach was totally against it. Like, why did you do that? Right. Like, I don't know. I don't know. I just kind of dropped down, but like, I
get on top.
But it felt great. I mean, looking back, I'm like, yeah, I should have done that more, but I mean, it is what it is. But, did you have many teammates that were sidearm submarine pitchers, John?
Good question. Let me think. I've definitely played with some guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Coming up, not so much. I think looking back that it really came from skipping rocks and then just being a quarterback and playing third base and first base. And
yeah.
And I'm also a long limbed guy. I'm 6'4" standing, but my wingspan's 6'8".
Nice.
So I have theories on that. Training guys too. I'm also right-handed and left eye dominant, which I have some theories on that too.
Huh.
And I think there's no absolutes. There's different, but I think there's definitely different ways that kind of allow guys to maybe succeed one way or another. And I think those are two factors that I think helped me, was being cross-eye dominant and then having super long limbs.
And I guess, John, like, what would be your favorite part about pitching from the lower arm slot?
I think the deception and then just the, talking to other hitters and how it was an uncomfortable at bat.
Yeah, no, for
you
sure.
You know, and then, like, you know, guys are going through and doing the cross over their face, the, you know, like, hey, I'm not facing this guy today, or, you know, especially – you know, seeing right-handers kind of stand in a box a little different, or, you know, seeing guys try to choke up, or, you know, just certain little things where I think the pitcher, we already know the pitcher has the advantage mathematically, but it locked me in as who I was. It felt very, very instinctive for me. So it made it a lot of fun. I liked pitching overhand too, but there was just something primal about it for me. And it became, you know, just kind of part of who I was.
And John, you touched a little bit earlier, kind of your college career. Could you talk to us a little bit about kind of what that looked like?
Okay. So, 1998 was my senior year of high school. I was throwing in the fall, kind of a fun story, but I use it on my guys and I think it might help somebody out there, but you just never know who's watching. Okay. And yeah, I had some offers and I was going to go play. I had a good arm. But what happened is I was pitching in a doubleheader. I threw the first game and there was a left-hander named Andy Van Hecken. And Andy was pitching the second game. And Greg Gunderson, who was ended up being my pitching coach at Michigan State for my first 3 years, he was there to recruit. So I just happened to strike out like 15 guys in the game before.
Nice.
And he saw me, even though he was there to watch somebody else. But then 1999, we'll fast forward. I went to Michigan State as a freshman. I got my first start against Ball State, which was a non-conference game. And then kind of from then on, I was a starter for the next 3 years and then, got a new pitching coach, Fletch, my senior year. And he moved me more as a bullpen guy. And it was kind of the idea of, you know, when he was dropping me down as well. We actually had another guy I'm thinking of right now, Michigan State, but his name's Brian Gale. He was a guy who threw two or three different slots. Really mixed it up, got into pro ball a little bit with the Blue Jays. Now he's a scout for the Brewers, but,
nice.
Anyways, had a lot of fun at Michigan State, maybe too much fun off the field. After graduating and not getting drafted, which I had always just saw myself getting drafted, I had kind of a big wake up and stopped partying and kind of some of the off the field stuff that was holding me back, and got real strict with my nutrition and got in good shape. And then from there, I went to indie ball and I guess kind of just partied from there, but baseball party.
Wow. And that was kind of like the next question there, John, like, you know, you had to go the indie ball route, but you ended up kind of getting signed out of indie ball a few times. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, four starts in 2003, I had a good start to the year. I was, you know, sitting 94, 96, had good life on the ball. And, I think it was six or seven teams that called to buy my contract. And I just so happened to have been in the office when the Brewers called, and the Brewers bought my contract, and I went to the Midwest League, which was a lot of fun. And then got released out of spring training, went back to indie ball. And then I was getting signed that day by the Brewers, and I broke my arm. So that was the day I broke my arm. That was in 2004, Chillicothe, Ohio. That was kind of another big wake up call. And then said no to snow, moved to Arizona. And first five surgeons told me I'd never pitch again. And I think that really lit a fire. And I just started looking for alternative methods for healing and recovery and training, and turned to a lot of martial arts and holistic nutrition, and kind of went away from the traditional. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went to Calgary with you, 2006.
Yeah.
And then 2007, I was in St. Paul, and then I got signed by the Rockies in between there. Got signed by the Rockies, got released out of spring training. The last day of spring training, I'd actually had a bulged disc in my back, L5-S1, in the off season, and didn't tell anybody. So was kind of just, I was still okay, but I just wasn't the same. And got released, got into shape. And then I went to St. Paul and had a really good year there. Then I went back to Calgary, and then I went Calgary, and then I got traded to Winnipeg. I got traded to Schaumburg. I played for Rockford Riverhawks after that. Played for the Yuma Scorpions after that. And then I played in the Freedom Pro Baseball League here in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny because I played 13 years professionally, but if you look it up online, you'll see 11. The league that we played in, it was a pro league. I had Joey Gathright playing center field. Julio Lugo was our shortstop. I mean, we had Brett Jenkins and Raff were our coaches. Dave Hilton was a coach. It was very, very incredible.
That league, actually.
But they didn't. So none of those stats show up, which is just crazy. Yeah. That's a whole nother topic. But after that, I got signed by the Milwaukee Brewers again. So I had, I broke some record about the longest time away from affiliated, signed back into affiliated. I think it was like 11 years. Even though I'd had a spring training spout in there, it wasn't any official innings. And then went and did really well there. It was a lot of fun. And then I got in a car accident in 2015. And that was kind of the biggest roadblock I guess I've faced so far was the car accident, just because lower back and some stuff that has taken years. We'll kind of see. I've been running a place called Fuel Factory, which you're familiar with.
Absolutely.
Here in Phoenix, we also had a place called the Backyard Baseball Lab, and I ran a facility called the Cages, and I ran a facility called It's All in the Game kind of during those times once I got hurt. And then we'll kind of see what happens. I've been doing a lot of training. I think you know me well enough to know that the car accident, ending my career would be just something I'm unwilling to settle for. Yeah. So I think it's just taken longer than I initially thought. I used to joke I was on the Olympic plan to play again and just train for 4 years and go play. But it's been since 2000. I got in a car accident actually right after I was driving home from the Sidearm Nation camp at Victory Lane when I got in my car accident. January 11th. And it was right before spring training. And so obviously that kind of, it put the brakes on it. But yeah, long story short, been doing a lot of training, and we'll kind of see where things are at maybe after this next year. And I've had some opportunities to maybe go play in Mexico or indie ball or overseas, or we'll see.
Yeah. So
let it continue, baby.
Yeah. No, I love that. Like, have you been kind of able to, like, you've been pitching in like some men's league a little bit, or?
Yeah. Yep. I've pitched in some men's leagues, had a lot of fun with that. And then I throw a lot with my guys, and then I've been throwing at the facility. I have, my Sifu, and then I have a body work guy that's been working on me, and we've had some really good results moving forward. So we're just going to, kind of continue that path and see what happens. Nice. You got to meet Sifu last year, so you've seen some of that conditioning that goes into
it. Impressive.
It's very challenging. So, like, especially initially, it was something that was very difficult to get through. And then just it's gotten better and better and better and better. And my body's starting to tell me it might be ready to go pitch again. So
nice.
It's hard to be like Satchel Paige or something, you know? Satchel Paige pitched till he was like 60.
Yeah.
How sick is that? I'm just going to have his attitude.
He's definitely impressive for me. I think one of the all-time greats, hey? Like to do what he did and travel.
Oh, I love Satchel Paige. The stories on him are, and then I think his favorite thing he says is, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you were? You know, that's and cool. It's like, I know. Some people say age is just a number, but that's like the same thing for me where it's like, there's a certain mindset, you know, that I've adapted, you know, I stole it from old Uncle Satchel, but, I love that story. And the fact that he went and pitched into his 60s. I mean, that's just sick.
Anything, John, like from a bullpen mindset, like I definitely had a bad habit of kind of probably wasting too many bullets down there. Like any advice from that?
For me, I know I typically liked getting my work in pregame.
Yeah.
So I had a little bit of a chance to recover. And then, I mean, you probably remember, I think there's been multiple times when we played together when managers would walk out of the bullpen and just, or out of the dugout and just, I'm on the mound. Didn't even ask me because they knew I was already loose.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, yes, I like to get some warm-up throws, but I think it starts with reading the game. Now, it helps if you have a consistent manager there that uses you in a role. But, you know, I think my favorite role I've ever had was the fireman role. So the starter starts to get into some trouble. A couple guys get on. I start to move around. You know, mentally, I start to see myself making pitches. I start to notice who's on deck. I start to, you know, read the lineup. I've been paying attention. Typically, the first few innings of the game, especially when I was in the bullpen, were more kind of just watching tendencies and seeing how guys reacted to the starter stuff, even if he threw different than I did. And then I think, you know, for me, the big thing was just those mental reps where it was like I was ready. You know, obviously you got to get your core temperature up and get your body moving, but I think a lot of it starts in between the ears, and it's having a healthy routine. You know, I'm a big visualization guy. So a lot of times, you know, I already threw that hitter the night before, you know, before I laid down to go to sleep, or maybe in the training room after BP, I was in there going through maybe a 5 to 7 minute just visualization, going, seeing my, each one of my pitches for a called strike, seeing each one of my pitches for a swing and miss. Did you ever play with Travis Hughes?
No, I didn't, but I know the name. Yeah.
So bullpen story. the thing I struggled with was coming in with guys on base, I'd be great. And then I'd go sit down after I finished the inning and I'd go out for the fresh inning. And it was always like, okay, now nobody's on base and nothing's happening. What's happening here? You know? And it was like, I'd almost, you know, you come in with guys on base and you got that adrenaline pumping and you, let's say you get a ground ball, double play, and inning's over, fist pump, go back in the dugout. A lot of times I think it was almost like, okay, my job's done. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, there's, yes, there's times where you're going to be used short like that, but there's other times you got to go back out. And Travis was a guy that talked to me about, I think when he was with the Yankees, he had a mental skills coach that would have him sit down with two outs when he's getting ready to go back out. Your team's hitting, two outs, close your eyes, see each one of your pitches for a called strike. See each one of your pitches for a swing and miss, righty and a lefty, you know? And like, if you've practiced it enough, it's like, it can, you know, and I like to make videos for my guys so you can practice seeing the visual you want to see too, but just see each one of your pitches doing what you want. And it's funny how, especially later in my career, it was like, that was a strength of mine. Whereas early on, it was something I struggled with, you know, especially going out for that next inning without the adrenaline pumping. And then all of a sudden it's a 2-0 count. You know, and I think that was a huge one for me.
And then you touched on it a little bit, John, like kind of, you know, with kind of transitioning into coaching, like how was that transition for you?
So I had coached in the off season ever since Fletch. So Fletch was my pitching coach 2001, my last year, 2002. My last year of college at Michigan State. And then in the off season, we would train kids together. He'd train me and then I'd help him train the kids, you know, and especially he would do more of the pitching stuff and I would do more of the physical workout stuff. And then it kind of just turned into, I had done, if you guys are familiar with the 90 mile per hour club, Paul Reddick's a guy, I used to do a lot of stuff for him. Off-season workouts, 10-minute at-home workouts, hotel workouts, basically just baseball lifestyle stuff, on-the-go meals, you name it, that kind of stuff. So I really, while I was playing, I was coaching. And I think coaching really actually taught me as much as it taught my students, you know, and it's kind of cool because it's something where my growth as a player was also improved by helping the younger kids. And then, you know, it transitioned into from there, I had the backyard baseball lab, which was basically my backyard. And then we had a pitching tunnel. We had weight stuff. And it was kind of the same idea. I got in a car accident and then Matthew Liberatore went in the first round and his dad, Anthony basically, I don't want to say talked me into, but he he helped me open Fuel Factory.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a concept that we had, you know, we had talked about a little bit and then he helped me start it and helped me on the business side with a lot of different things. And now we're about 4 years in. We've trained over 170 major leaguers and over 300 professional guys. And it's kind of become just a, I guess just a baseball school. I mean, pitching, hitting, defense, mental stuff. But we really look at it as like, it's a classroom. It's a place where guys come to fail. Guys come to do trial and error. It's kind of a clubhouse in a way.
Yeah.
But you've been there. It's a pretty unique, it's been a humbling experience getting to watch. I mean, just as it grows, you know, and the more guys that have came in there, I mean, especially like you'd be some proud Sidearm Nation guys, but not just that, but a lot of other guys too. So,
yeah, no, it was an awesome place to have our camp and look forward to having it again, I guess coming up here in the new year. And, how cool was it to, can you talk to us a little bit about kind of getting able to see like Matthew's MLB debut?
It was unbelievable. Yeah, we had Matthews debut, especially since he's like a little brother to me. We've trained together since he was 11 years old.
Wow.
So, yeah, just a 20 years older than him. So it's something where it's almost like getting to watch almost a full career, kind of develop as it goes. It's been really awesome. I mean, it gives me goosebumps. I was a hot mess, as we were kind of joking, but it was just an emotional roller coaster, but it was obviously it's his career.
Yeah.
And I'm a guide. I've been able to help, but also at the same time as a baseball brother, it's so cool to see such a hardworking kid get opportunities, and then just to continue to do his thing. We actually had two other debuts this year too. We had Bo Brisky with Detroit Tigers, who's a guy that's been around since when I coached at Glendale Community College. Nice. And he's a guy who was a converting guy at the time and just always saw something special in him, and his work ethic is way up there. And then we had Penn Murphy, who's a Sidearm Nation guy.
Absolutely.
Have you ever talked to Penn?
Yeah, I had him on actually a few weeks ago. Yep.
I love Penn. So awesome. Yeah, so guy. His debut was was awesome too, and it was a fun year watching the Fuel Chuckers out there. It's almost hard to put to words what all the emotions and feelings that have gone into it.
Well, I bet. Yeah, Penn's a pretty cool story too, hey? Like just how he was a position player at Vanderbilt and kind of transitioned into just a regular over-the-top pitcher and then eventually dropped down and realized that was going to be his ticket, hey?
Did you interview him?
Yeah, a few weeks ago.
I got to go back and watch that. Did he happen to mention anything about our Sedona adventure?
I don't think so.
All right, we'll have to talk about that sometime. Okay. We'll save that one for another time. But we like to take guys to Sedona. Sedona's
it's a cool spot.
Pretty unique place, but it's also, I think for Penn, without speaking for him, I think sometimes the game, things get heavy with the game sometimes. I think it's easy to see all the good things that are going on, but at the same time, there's a lot of things that go on. And we went up to Sedona. We take players up to Sedona just kind of to reconnect to nature and to themselves. And I think it's a place that makes you feel really small, and it can really kind of just free you. I know it does for me. I go there on a regular basis, but just to kind of tap into that feeling.
Yep.
And, we had a monumental day. I'm just going to say that's the word that came to my head, but with Mark, myself and Penn up in Sedona this off season, it was really awesome.
Nice. Yeah. I plan on going there for a couple of days after the camp. I guess I went there too, after last year, and it's a pretty cool spot.
I'll drop you a few pins. You can go check out some of my magic spots. Okay. You can go get some of the healing waters up there.
Okay. No, I appreciate that.
Uh-huh.
And then, John, it's just time for our ninth inning call to the bullpen. So just going to be some random questions just to learn a little bit more about you.
Oh, out of here now. Let's go.
Favorite NHL team?
I'd say the Red Wings.
Favorite travel destination?
I mean, Sedona is only an hour and a half away from me, but I go there every other week. It's my favorite place to go. I've been to Alaska. I love Alaska, and I've also been to Hawaii, and I love Hawaii. So I'd say those are probably, I gave you three, but.
All-time favorite professional wrestler?
Ooh, that's a good one. Probably Hulk Hogan.
Favorite baseball movie of all time?
Another good one. So I'm going to watch over and over and over and over again. I'm going to say The Natural.
Yep. And John, if you could golf or have dinner with any three people, dead or alive, who would you like to go with?
Let's say I'm going to take Jesus, Walter Johnson, and Nolan Ryan, maybe. Yeah, I'll go with those three. Just because I haven't met him. I mean, I have some buddies that I would take just as of right now, but since you threw it out there, that's where my brain went.
Would you want it to be golf or dinner?
Ooh. I mean, if when I play golf, I play like tin cup and just bring my 7-iron. And I'm more of a driving range type of player. So I'd say probably dinner for me.
Any particular place?
I'm going to say sushi right now.
Yeah,
sushi. Sounds proper.
I like it.
I do like a lot of different foods, but sushi seems like a pretty primal. And Walter and I might start, you know, a food fight and start just dotting people.
If you could be an Olympian in any sport other than baseball, summer or winter, what sport would you like to do, John?
I get to just pick.
Yeah.
That's pretty sweet. Let's say high jumper.
High jump. Yeah.
But I was thinking like a decathlete too, like somebody that just kind of does all the,
I don't know how they do it. It's impressive.
I guess if I could just, that's like a superhero. So that'd be pretty fun.
And then lastly, John, just going to test your teammates here on the 2010 Rochford River Hawks. Do you remember your former teammate that used to play on the Dutch national team? I guess he was a hitter.
Randall Simon?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Randall Simon. I'm glad it wasn't a roster. Have you ever looked at that roster? I'm guessing you did. Do you see how many guys were on that roster? I'm pretty sure only three guys started the year in the bullpen and ended the year in the bullpen. I'm pretty sure it's three or four.
Yeah, that's the thing. I've always got to be tricky with those questions because you never know, like, if you were actually there or it depends on timing or, but it looked like you were there. Yeah, you were there the whole season.
Yeah, I was. Yep. I was one of those guys, but it was just musical chairs like you would not believe. That was probably Yuma was a lot that way, but more because spring training, we had 100 guys and Jose Canseco and Ozzie Canseco were our coaches, and they cut half the guys the first day on a whiteboard.
Wow.
And it was a absolute ruckus. But anyways.
Actually,
that's a whole other podcast. I could tell stories about that team just from.
Yeah. Like I was going to say, like, I mean, I was only on that team for like the 5 days in Calgary, but that that was a memorable team, right? Like with Joey Gathright and, James Hoyt and.
Yeah. Willie Ibar, Tony Phillips. I mean, so many guys on that team.
Well, I guess like Robbie Scott's going to come out and be an instructor.
Yeah, Robbie.
My Florida camp coming up here, and he was on that, I guess.
I love that kid. I guess he's a retired baseball player. And I said a kid, but he's still a kid, okay? Because I was, yeah. Hoyter was on that team too.
That was a fun team.
Unreal.
No,
yeah, you did. That's right. You did play on that team. That's so great.
Yeah, and even just with Canseco there, it was definitely kind of like a surreal 5 days. It was cool.
Yeah, and that was the full season for me. It was a and it was a traveling circus.
I bet. No, I appreciate you coming on, John. Is there any shout outs before we sign off?
I mean, I just shout out to you for having me on. I love it. I think if anything, just inspire everybody else out there to keep working on themselves and working on their games. And if there's anything I can do to help anyone, I think, Jeff will probably put out there how you can contact me, but pretty easy to get a hold of. So if there's anything I can do to help anybody, just let me know.
She said, "Do you come from a land down under where women glow and men plunder? Can't you hear the thunder? Yeah. You better run, you better take cover. Yeah. You better run, you better take cover.